This is Herb Montgomery with Renewed Heart Ministries, and I welcome you to this week's weekly podcast. Our feature text this week is Luke 4, verse 18, where Jesus says, "The Spirit of the Lord is on me to set the oppressed free." This week's title, the title of this week's podcast, is Newton's Amazingly Inaccurate Grace Myth. And I've gotten that from Keisha McKenzie, which I'll tell you more about in just a moment. I want to thank all of you, first of all, for the overwhelmingly positive feedback that I received from last week's podcast. And I also want to thank Keisha McKenzie specifically for her, what I think was very timely correction of my comments regarding John Newton. And for those who missed our exchange on Facebook, I'll try to catch up here this week. Keisha pointed out that John Newton, and this is what she said, I'm just going to read to you her words, this is what she messaged me. John Newton did not turn away from slaving immediately after his conversion. He didn't confess supporting abolition for another 40 years. He converted to evangelicalism in 1748. Stopped actively trading in 1754, but only for medical reasons. He had a stroke. And he did not write against the slave trade until 1788. In other words, his private conversion had no impact on his relationship to the slave trade for four decades. Christianity switched no lights on for him regarding the relationship of white people and black people for 40 years. And Keisha went on to say that we don't have that kind of time to wait for the privately pious to become publicly concerned. And the reason I want to feature Keisha's correction this week is because I agree with her point. We don't have that kind of time to wait for private piety to work its way through to being concerned in these public matters. As I went back and researched Keisha's comments, this is what I found out, that according to historians, John Newton basically gave up profanity, gambling, and drinking after converting to evangelical Christianity in 1748, but he continued to work in the slave trade. Keisha's absolutely right. Although Newton did say, this is at his book, Out of the Depths, he wrote, "I cannot consider myself to have been a believer in the full sense of the word until a considerable time afterwards." What I want you to notice this week is that he saw nothing wrong with the slave trade for another 40 years after his conversion. The first fruits of his Christian life was in giving up swearing, gambling, and alcohol. It had nothing to do with how he related to some of these larger issues. And I don't fault Newton for this. I don't think it's Newton's fault at all. What I fault this week is the type of Christianity that Newton became a convert of. Newton applied to be ordained as a priest in 1757. He studied Greek, he studied Hebrew, Syriac, he was a lay minister, and finally he was accepted and ordained in 1764, and still he would not speak publicly, he would not speak out against the slave trade, which he had been a part of, for another 20 years after that. In 1788, Newton published Thoughts Upon the Slave Trade. That's almost a decade after his famous hymn was published, Amazing Grace. He also apologized. It says it was a confession which comes too late, he says. "It will always be a subject of humiliating reflection to me that I was once an active instrument in a business at which my heart now shudders." And that's from Adam Hochschild's book, Bearing the Chains, The British Struggle to Abolish Slavery. But notice, all of this, even Newton says, comes too late. Newton would later join William Wilberforce in publicly working to end the African slave trade, and we know that history, and he would continue doing that for the next 20 years. But still, he had been he'd been a Christian for 40 years leading up to this. And in last week's eSight, I made the statement that if one is privately a follower of Jesus, then one should publicly be involved in ending systems of oppression and privilege. And my question this week, thanks to Keisha, delved into John Newton's history more deeply, past the myth. And my question, after delving into this history, thanks to Keisha's correction, my question is, how does one privately become a Christian, publicly become a priest in the Church of England, but it take 20 to 40 years of being exposed to Jesus to publicly come out as believing that there's something fundamentally wrong with treating other humans as lesser beings or items of property. And I can speak somewhat to this because to a degree, this is my story too. Before the night of August 27, 2010, which is when I encountered Jesus' Sermon on the Mount for the very first time, I too was reading the Bible through a very conventional, domesticated lens that had been handed to me by white evangelical male-dominated Christian culture. And it was this encounter that marked a beginning for me. And there I was, encountering Jesus' Sermon on the Mount. I was alone in a hotel room after a radio interview on the second largest Christian radio station in America and feeling as if I was meeting Jesus for the very first time. And I want to be clear, this was just a beginning for me. I'm still discovering ways in which I think and interpret the world around me, ways of reading the Jesus story and that I think are a product of a very conventional, domesticated Christianity that serves the purpose of a privileged class rather than Jesus' new world. And this is a Christianity, if you want to contrast them, this is a Christianity that's focused more on postmortem destinations than on healing the world around us in the here and now. As Jesus said in Luke 9, verse 2, it says he sent the disciples out to proclaim the kingdom and to heal the sick. They had a very this world, right here and right now, alleviating suffering, now focus. This is a Christianity that's intent on escaping this world, judging it as too far gone, instead of, like in the book of Revelation, following a Jesus who is making everything new. And that's Revelation 21, verse 5. This is a Christianity that directs its followers, its devotees, toward a private, personal, individual, spiritual relationship with God, while at the same time neglecting the need to be publicly engaged in confronting oppressive systems and cleansing modern-day temples of the privilege, like Jesus did in the Jesus story. It's a Christianity that allows its adherents to live respectable, religiously pious lives, rather than being put on crosses or lynched for standing against the status quo. It's a Christianity that doesn't need the resurrection, because it will never find itself on a cross. It will never find itself on trial before the economic, like with Herod, the political, like with Pilate, or the religious, like with Caiaphas, social structures of the day, in danger of an execution that's being demanded by the Democratic majority, or as in the Jesus story, it was just called the crowd. It has very little to do with changing the world around us. It's too preoccupied with getting off this rock. It fails to embrace what I think is the life-giving truth found in that old spiritual sung by African slaves under the yoke of white owners when they would sing, "I got a home in that rock." In short, what I'm saying this week is that I'm discovering on a daily basis that as a white evangelical Christian male, that there's a lot of things within the Jesus story and the way that I've interpreted it that I've just simply been wrong. As I listen to the theological voices of those who read the Jesus narrative through the lens of oppression, whether it be in matters of race, economics, gender, or orientation, I'm discovering that I've been wrong. The Jesus that I was worshiping was very different from the one that I'm encountering and learning to follow in the stories of Matthew, Mark, Luke, and John. And the Jesus that I was worshiping conveniently never changed the world of the oppressors who hold their tickets to heaven in one hand and their oppression in the other. And in the end, it won't be my white evangelical background that I'll be able to credit. Just like John Newton, my background, this evangelical background, it didn't turn on any lights for me. When I take my place one day at Creator's table, it will be the intersectional lenses of black stories, of female voices, and of queer theologians, and the wisdom of those who walk in our societies without having two pennies to rub together, that I'll have to look at and thank for introducing this straight, white, cisgender, male preacher to the Jesus of the Jesus narrative. And I still believe that a new world began in the first century. And I still believe that those to whom the announcement of this new world was entrusted, I still believe that they allowed themselves to experience a radical change of course. To this day, many of their progeny are still unaware that the course has even been changed. Others feel out of place in their spiritual communities. They sense that something's wrong, and they spend their lives trying to rediscover within Christianity what's been lost. And others simply look at it all and say it's just too far gone. But I'm becoming more and more convinced as I look at the Jesus story and this new world that began in Jesus through the lens of those that are on the fringes of our society that are marginalized. I become convinced that the Spirit, undeterred, has continued to speak in every generation, and that the new world, it still is growing. And regardless of creed, race, gender, orientation, economic status, it's growing in those who are willing to listen to its whisperings. In this holiday season, it strikes me that although much of what I'm discovering in the Jesus narrative is revolutionary to me personally, it's a narrative with a long history, and it's a history that's among this world's oppressed. I'm discovering before me a path that not only stretches far ahead of me, it stretches far behind me as well. This is not a path that we're called to blaze or create. This is a path that reaches all the way back to the Gospels, and it has woven its way not through empirical Christendom, but along its societal fringes instead. It's also a path that we, especially white Christian males like myself, are being invited to step onto today, so that in humility, we can be taught by those that are already on this path what it has always truly meant to follow a liberating Jesus, a Jesus which, according to Luke 6, 20 through 22, a Jesus who has always been standing alongside in solidarity with those at the bottom of our societies. It's much to think about this holiday season. I wish each of you a happy holidays as you celebrate with friends or with family, wherever this finds you, till the only world that remains is a world where love reigns. I love you guys. I'll see you next week.